This podcast is brought to you by Maine Operation Game Thief, New Hampshire Wildlife Heritage Foundation, and International Wildlife Crime Stoppers. This podcast is brought to you in part by Sovereign Sportsman Solutions. As conservation officers, we know just how important technology is in this day and age. S3 is a cutting-edge and trusted vendor that provides state agencies with licensing, mobile, CRM, marketing, law enforcement, and event management solutions all in one place. They are dedicated to benefiting the resource, so check out the link in the show notes to sign up for their newsletter and get the industry insights, news, and content that can keep you up to date on the tech that helps drive conservation into the future. Listen to the Thin Green Line podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. Game wardens John Norris and Wayne Saunders talk about wildlife, the outdoors, law enforcement, environmental subjects mixed with current events and guests that are part of the Thin Green Line. And if you are one of those visual people, like me, for $5 a month, you can see the actual podcast on Patreon.com. Just search the Thin Green Line podcast on Patreon.com and join us.
We love our children. We protect them. We guide them. We prepare them for life in the world. With all that we do, from deep in our hearts, we cannot control all things. Life-threatening illnesses and disabilities affect far too many of our children each year. While we cannot change the circumstance, we can make dreams come true. Dreams to provide hope, to provide spiritual healing and strength, to provide moments of happiness and relief in the hardest of times. We can give a glimmer of light and hope in a time of darkness and despair. Join huntofalifetime.org to help make dreams come true, to provide hope for children with life-threatening illnesses and disabilities. Hunt of a Lifetime is a nonprofit organization fulfilling dreams for hunting and fishing trips to youth 21 and under with life-threatening illnesses and disabilities. Visit huntofalifetime.org to learn how you can make a difference.
Please join me, Game Warden Wayne Saunders, and other Game Wardens on our adventures, protecting wildlife, saving lives, and having fun, all while serving the public and the natural resources of our planet. Listen to the tales and experiences of those who work in the outdoors while being entertained with stories about encounters with poachers, wildlife investigation, murder investigation, near-death experiences, search and rescue missions, wildlife interactions from game wardens around the country and around the world. When I retired, I realized I couldn't let go of that legacy, but rather wanted to share the passion, the commitment, and the stories of those men and women that call themselves game wardens. This is Game Warden Wayne Saunders, and this is Warden's Watch. Episode 60, For the Fallen, Justin Hirse. This podcast, we interview Justin Hirse's father, Alan Hirse, about his son's in the line of duty death. And it was so impactful to hear the story from a father about his son that was killed in the line of duty 14 years ago. And you guys, I just want you as listeners, try to think about your father telling this story, or think about, you know, if it was your son killed in the line of duty and you're telling the story. Just those role reversals, and it was a tough one for me, John. It was, you know, it hit home. I mean, it's just you're listening to a father tell a story about how his son was killed in the line of duty, because he doesn't want anybody to forget his son. He doesn't want to forget his son, and he wants to share everything about his son that he can with the world. I really appreciate him and the strength he had to do this podcast and tell Justin's story. So that's a special thing.
Yeah, you know, it's, Wayne, it's tragic and beautiful all at the same time. I mean, it's this dichotomous feeling of what's happening here. And when you think about the fact that parents should never have to bury their children, you know, that's so outside of, you know, what is expected in a lifetime of while we're put on this earth. And especially when you bury your son that committed his life to protecting our resources, to protecting the public, and you're so proud of that as a parent, and you got to relive not only the joy and the pride of everything your son stood for, but the devastating loss of losing your son before his time, or before what could have happened. And this one's deep, but it just goes to show you how much sacrifice that all of our officers on the Thin Green Line of Conservation and our Thin Blue Line of City Police officers and all law enforcement officers and first responders face, and the heartbreak that may come to the family with the risks we take. But this is an example of, like you said, Wayne, really well said, is he does not want to lose that memory of his son, and he doesn't want the world to lose the memory and the significance and not honor the work his son did. And that's beautiful. As tragic as the situation is, that's beautiful. It needs to happen. Story needs to be told. And it has to reinforce the risks we take and the value of what we do out there. And we're really lucky that so many people, especially our listeners and our viewers, and we love you guys for this, really take to heart what we're doing out there. And you're as passionate as we are to the guys on the ground and the women on the ground working firsthand on the front lines. And this is a story of, you know, the risks we take, and we don't always come home. And that's a sobering reality that we have to face and never take the job lightly, because that is the ultimate end game.
For sure. And you'll hear his wife, Justin's mother, Pat, every now and then chime in the background. She doesn't want Alan to forget stuff. It was very endearing. I found it. And she's a very special lady. And it was for sure. And I quote her in the end, something I found online. So we're going to lead this one in with a prayer from Texas Wildlife, Parks and Wildlife Chaplain Scott McIntosh, who led our last For the Fallen podcast last year. He led the prayer into that. So I just think it's so appropriate that Scott's from Texas Parks and Wildlife as a chaplain and to lead this memorial podcast to Justin Hurst, who was killed in line of duty.
Heavenly Father, we come to you this day to thank you for all the men and women who work in different parts of our nation as game wardens, fish and game officers, and all the different nomenclatures used to describe those who protect our natural resources as well as the citizens of these United States. We're cognizant of and remember daily those men and women who have given their last and greatest measure as they were performing their duties. Men like Justin Hurst from Texas, who, with duty and honor, was taken from his family, from his department, and ultimately from all the citizens of Texas. Men and women throughout the United States, Lord, feel such a pride and sense of duty that they are, at any given time, ready to lay down their lives for a calling larger than themselves. Thank you for people such as these. It is a great honor to serve with these type of individuals and teams. May the people of each state understand and lift high those who, in many cases, go unnoticed, but who serve nonetheless. Thank you for allowing us to know our game wardens, to have the honor of praying for them each day, to lift them and their families up, and even to watch with amazement our canine officers as they perform their duties. Protect them all and help them to know how much they are loved by the citizens of their state. In your name, amen.
So today's on Warden's Watch, we are doing our memorial podcast. And this is one of the toughest podcasts I do, because I relate, and I think all of us relate. All of us have been in those situations where it could have been us, and I think it's so important to tell the stories of our fallen. I don't want to forget. I don't think you want to forget. I don't think our listeners want to forget. I think our listeners want to know and understand the game wardens that have fallen in our past. And today, I have the distinct privilege of interviewing Mr. Alan Hurst, the father of Justin Hurst, Texas game warden, killed in the line of duty 14 years ago. Thank you so much for joining us, Mr. Hurst. It's tough. It's a tough subject, but when they're gone, to carry on and tell their stories, I think it's a pretty special. And I know we and your wife were talking, myself and your wife were talking about making lemonade out of lemons. And she certainly said a lot of that lemonade never gets sweet, Wayne. And boy, I think that says it all. You can try to make lemonade out of lemons, but it's never going to get sweet. It's a tough thing. But I want everybody to know Justin. I want to know, you know, his commitment, his ultimate sacrifice, And then the stuff that you guys as a family went through, the aftermath, that's something that I haven't exposed listeners to yet. And for me, I'm reviewing all this information. That was a traumatic moment for me to think about what you guys had to go through after. You lose a son, and now you got to go through a trial. And ultimately, he has to pay for his crime. Again, thank you for joining us, Mr. Hurst. I so appreciate it. Like to start with Justin from the beginning.
Okay. Justin was born in Wheat Ridge, Colorado, when we were living in Denver, Colorado. I was involved in professional football for 21 years. So that's where he was born. Justin really enjoyed the outdoors. You know, it's a different type of weather up there than what we have down in Texas. He enjoyed the snow and he enjoyed playing in it and playing with the dogs. He was a great lover of dogs. And I think every place we went, he ended up with dogs and also bringing other people's dogs that they got rid of. But he had this desire to be in the outdoors. And when we moved to Texas, we lived fairly close to the Trinity River,
San Jacinto River.
So he spent quite a lot of his time down at the river fishing and looking at wildlife. One day he came home and he said, "Dad, we need to go back down." He said, "We found two hawks that have been snared." And he said, "I can't get them." So we went down to the river and were able to capture the hawks and take them to a rehabber. She was able to take and save both of those hawks. And I think that was maybe one of the times that he kind of started thinking of that's what he wanted to do, was be in the outdoors and learn as much as he could about wildlife and be a biologist. He really started, it was, I think, mainly when he got into high school. And we were going out to a place called Monaville, and outward dove hunting was going on and everything. And we were able to meet one of the biologists out there. So Justin made contact with him and became very interested in it. And as soon as Justin turned 16, we ended up getting a truck for him. And after that time, we never saw him anymore. But, you know, of course, those were the days when things were a lot different than what they are now. Mm. But anyway, he ended up spending a lot of time with the biologist and learning things about nature and what all biologists do and with the different seasons and of capturing of birds and habitats and stuff like that. I think that's where he really got the interest of that's what he wanted to go into. Then he made some contacts with some other people and ended up guiding. And you know, to be a guide at 16 is
wow,
kind of something different. But he had built up a reputation of being a very good guide. It basically went from there of him learning about guiding He was very lucky that he had some tremendous people that taught him not only about dove hunting and guiding, but in his big thing was the duck and geese. That's what he really fell in love to. Then he met a person by the name of David Loprice, who was a biologist. And in 1988-89 season down here, we had a avian cholera breakout. And Justin volunteered to work with this biologist and collecting all the dead birds and everything and destroying them. He really took a liking to Mr. Loprice, and David really enjoyed having him and working with him. David had two girls and he didn't have a boy. So he loved Justin so much that he adopted him as a son, because it was something he always wanted and he didn't have. Mm-hmm. So that relationship relationship there really was very strong for Justin. And he was David was a biologist, worked with duck and geese and also deer. And so I think that was the one person that really pushed Justin into being a biologist. Then he started guiding more and more as he got older. He was one of the guides for the largest rice farm in around the Houston area, the Jordan Farms. Here again, he met Trent Jordan, and their relationship became very strong, and he was a guide with them. He learned a lot from Trent about calling and habitats and everything that's involved with hunting duck and geese. So that relationship was very strong. Then later on, he got involved again with a Texas Parks and Wildlife biologist, and they asked him if he would be interested in monitoring and reading bands on geese. This was when they were putting the big round collars on geese and stuff. And so what they wanted him to do was to go out and look in the fields and see if he could find geese that had bands and read the numbers on them. And it was a way of tracking the geese coming down and where they were from. So that was, you know, that part of it just pushed him that much more through high school. He decided to go to Texas A&M University, which is a very large university as far as wildlife, and they have an extremely good program there for wildlife management. And that's what he really was interested in going into. Here again, during his time at A&M, which is interesting in that they have football. The only thing is that football interfered with duck and goose season.
Oh, boy.
And Justin never went to a single football game because he was out working either with the biologist or working as a guide. He's probably the only Aggie I know that never went to a single football game while his 4 years there. But that was his desire, and that's what he was interested in. Justin was the type of kid that he did a lot of research, a lot of study, and, you know, really find out what he's interested in doing.
Yeah,
that
says so much about a person, Mr. Hurst, when you go to Texas A&M and you don't go to a football game. I think it describes a lot of outdoor people too, because growing up, baseball and all of that wasn't a big deal for me. Opening day of hunting season was my opening day of baseball, and I as you're saying that, I think a lot of people are going to stand in Justin's shoes like that, because it's a different game that we played using the outdoors. And in this day and age, and I'm sure you see it, you know, my son, hockey season is day in and day out. And I didn't have those opportunities back, 40 years ago. We didn't have those opportunities to play all these games and stuff. And that's kind of taking the place of how we grew up in the outdoors. So, but I can see myself in Justin's shoes, because I think I'd rather be out with him and the goose and the ducks and looking for bands and the biologists than going to the Texas A&M games. So that just says volumes about his love for the outdoors and his love for wildlife. Special thing you shared with us. Thank you on that. So please continue on. I didn't mean to interrupt you, but it's just
it's interesting to hear different stories from different people and you know, what they did in their childhood growing up. But he loved the outdoors and especially the goose and ducks, and fell in love with Wharton County. That's where he was doing most of his guiding and biology work at the time. So he graduated from A&M and became a technician, working with biologists for about the first 6 months out of college. Then the opportunity came around to apply for a position at Peach Point, which is the largest wildlife management facility around the Houston area. It is 15,000 acres of property, and it's set aside for hunting duck, geese, and deer, and fishing, and also dove. So the opportunity came by, and he applied for it. And I think there were 300 and some people applied for the job. I think what really helped Justin was the fact that he had worked so much with these biologists in his previous years. They knew what his work ethics were. Justin had very strong work ethics. He wouldn't quit. He wanted to learn as much as he possibly could. So anyway, he applied for the job and he became the new manager of Peach Point. He held that position for about 7 years. At that time, he decided that he still liked learning and stuff at Peach Point and taking care of that. And, you know, all the problems you have with hurricanes, and you got all the flooding and everything that comes into those lowlands and stuff. But so he decided that he would like to maybe spend more time with kids. He decided to become a game warden. So he applied for Game Warden Academy. Our academy down here is a 7-month academy. It's a very long academy. It's a very tough academy. I'm sure all game wardens go through a tremendous amount of training and everything in their academies. But what was interesting there is that not only do they do the regular law enforcement education, same thing as our DPS down here, our state troopers and everything, but then they have the section of where you have to learn all the regulations and everything of wildlife management. And one of the classes that is taught there at the academy is duck and goose identification. And it just so happened that they had him teach the class since he had the, wow, the best knowledge and the teaching of duck and goose. So he taught his class in as far as that section of the schooling. I might mention that there were 48 cadets in the class, and Justin, after, you know, when he graduated, he was ranked number one in his class of 48 game wardens.
Wow.
He,
I was just glad I passed Mr. Hurst. To be number one, that says a lot.
But, I mean, that just gives you an idea of
it does
his knowledge and his his love and stuff for wildlife management. He enjoyed it. Of course, you know, being the new kid on the street, he had to apply to an area that you know, where would you like to go? Well, the area that you know that he had to go was back to Bryan, which is where Texas A&M is. Well, there's not a heck of a lot of geese and ducks around that area stuff. So that was his first station. We were kind of happy because that's where we were living at the time, was in Bryan. But anyway, he made it through his first year. Then the opening came about in Wharton County, where he actually had been living when he was the biologist down at Peach Point. So he applied for it. And you normally have to stay at your one station for at least 2 years. But they understood, Justin, that the relationship that he had with the people in Wharton County and the farmers and everything down here, they allowed him to apply for it, and he ended up getting the position as game warden in Wharton County. We have two game wardens in Wharton County. So he was happy to be back where his love and everything was. So that's, he was happy. He was pleased to be back in, and
back home.
You know, Yeah, he knew the people around and all the ranchers and the farmers and stuff. And he had a lot of connections and working with these people, and they trusted him. And, you know, I think that's one of the big things that game wardens need is to really make those personal contacts with your farmers and ranchers. And those relationships can really help you a lot. It gives, you know, you more information and a lot of support, and you know, it's kind of a working together type situation, and you can help both cases. So anyway, he was back down into Wharton County. He was very happy. He got married. Then later on, he ended up having a son, Kyle, who is now 14 years old. Mm. He was 4 months old when his father was killed. We had just moved down here, retired from Texas A&M, and we had moved down to be with him and his family, and to be able to finally do some things with him that we hadn't been able to do. I mean, my wife and I both like to fish. We like to kayak and spend time on the water. So we figured it was going to be a great time for us to get together and be able to do those things with him that we hadn't been able to do in a long time. We moved down to El Campo. We couldn't find the house at the time, or we couldn't move into our house at the time. So we were living with them for 2 weeks. His wife had gone into Houston that night for a meeting. And so Justin said, well, we've had some calls about poaching, and I'm going to go do a little night out, check around and see if we can find out what's going on. He left that night, and Amanda came home. Of course, the next day was St. Patty's Day, which happens to be Justin's birthday. He would be turning 34 the next day. So we were, you know, excited. We were going to have a birthday, small birthday party for him and everything. So his wife came home, and about 1 o'clock in the morning, there were knocks at the door. I heard them, and I thought, well, you know, Justin must have left his keys, something at home for him to be knocking at the door. Mm-hmm. And so I got up, and about that time, Amanda came down the hall. So she saw the flashlight, and she told the person, she said, go away. And the person said, no, we need to talk. And so she opened up the front door. It was Justin's captain from Victoria. And he informed us that Justin had been shot and was being transported to Memorial Hermann Hospital in Houston, and that we needed to immediately get dressed and go to the hospital. So we did. You know, those four knocks are something that you'll remember your entire life. Mm-hmm. So we went into Houston to the hospital. When we arrived at the hospital, there was about 15, 20 game wardens there at the hospital. When we got there, we were informed that Justin did not make it. So we met with the doctors and everything, and they explained to us what had happened. And he had received two shots, one in the buttocks and one in his side. He was at the scene. He was kneeling down to take a shot. His vest did not cover the side of your body. That's where he got shot, was in the side. So my next question was, well, is there anything that, you know, as far as parts of his body that could be donated to other people? And they said no, due to the fact that the amount of damage that it had done to his internal organs, that there was nothing that could be used. The only thing that they actually were able to use was his eyes. And he had fantastic eyes, mm-hmm. because he could see geese farther than I think anybody else could. So that was part of it that, you know, was good that his eyes were used. So we returned back to El Campo. When we started coming down the road, there were about 20, 25 game wardens already at the house. you know, a lot of hugs and everything, and a lot of tremendous support from Texas Parks and Wildlife. They kept the news media away from us, and so it was, you know, a pretty tough time. But later on that afternoon, the case had been turned over to the Texas Rangers. So we met with the Texas Ranger that afternoon, and he explained everything that had happened and what was going on, so that they, you know, the person that had done the shooting and everything had been captured, and that Justin had shot. And Justin had been shot. And he had also shot the person that shot him. He had shot the young man in the arm and also in the legs. What had happened was that they had had problems with somebody on the road of shooting, poaching off the road. And there was one of the other game wardens that was there, and he was out that night, and Justin was on the way over, and they heard the gunshot. The other game warden went to the location of where the shot came from, and there was a guy there with a rifle, and he had shot actually a possum off the road. The game warden tried to stop the individual. He refused to stop. So from that point on, for about an hour and a half, there was a pursuit that happened on back roads and over on the highway, and speeds up to almost 100 miles an hour. So the game warden immediately called in other units that were in the area. And we had constables that came in, the Wharton County Sheriff Department had four units that were in the chase, DPS, which is our state patrol, they were involved. So a total of about 10 other units were involved, plus two game wardens. Most of these units had dash cams. So everything that happened that night was taped. The pursuit continued, and finally the young man came back down a back road, and they were able to take and put out strips and spikes and punctured. Well, before that, Justin had come into play, and he was taking a back road. The guy ended up coming down that road, and Justin tried blocking the road. The guy went off into a ditch on the other side and just sideswiped Justin's vehicle. So once he did that, that puts a whole new situation into it. The chase continued. One of the deputy sheriffs from Wharton County was a retired Marine. And once his comments was, once I saw that his car was sideswiped, that this was going to be a whole different ballgame. And so he pulled his .45 and set it in his lap, because he felt that something was going on that time. So anyway, the young man continued, went across the train track, and went into a circle drive to a cemetery. And once he got into the middle of the road, he turned his truck sideways, and the rest of these vehicles that had been in this pursuit all immediately came right in and kind of circled where he couldn't come out. Mm-hmm. The young man got out of the truck. They knew that he had a rifle. You know, they figured it was probably a .22. He got out of the car with a .357 Glock, started coming down the back side of the truck, going down the rail of the truck, shooting at the police cars. And he was shooting at, you know, whatever one that, you know, he could hit. But he went the entire length of the truck. He was counting. He had practiced this before, so he knew how many rounds he had in his gun. And then he started coming back up. and he was shooting it at the police units that were up close. Mm. He came back and opened the back door of the truck. Some of the police officers started firing into that area, hoping, you know, from the other side, hoping that they could possibly hit him. And Justin had opened up his door. He was the only one out there that night that had an AR-15, and it was laying on his back seat. So he got out of his truck, and he was dressed all in black and went down into a ditch that was right next to the cemetery and went up against the fence, a cyclone fence. When the man, young man got out of his truck this time, he had an AK-47 with 30-round clip of Russian-made hollow point rounds. He came out, and Justin fired, I think, four rounds and hit him three times. But they were not rounds or shots that were going to kill. And he was trying to strictly wound the guy, hit him in the leg and arms. And when the guy came up this time, he had his AK. Justin was shooting military rounds, which has tracers in them. And he picked up the tracers on Justin's gun coming out. Justin was kneeled down to shoot. The guy fired at Justin and hit the fence, the cyclone fence next to Justin. And then he ended up hitting two rounds into Justin. Then he turned and started firing at the other units again. And then he decided that there were some woods in back of him, and he knew the area very well. He lived about two or three blocks from the cemetery. So he decided that he was going to make a run for it. He had his other clip in his pocket, and he started making a run, and one of the deputy sheriffs was able to take and shoot him and shot him in the ankle. And he lost his other clip, and then he ended up falling down because of the ankle injury. Then they went over to him and was able to take the gun away from him. In the meantime, they were trying to help Justin as much as they could. They tried giving him CPR, but there was one of the DPS that was an EMT that carried IVs with him. He tried to give Justin an IV to try to get some nourishment and something back into his system, but Justin's veins and everything had started collapsing because he was losing such a large amount of blood due to the amount of damage internally. Lifelight was called in, and they immediately lifelighted him to Houston Hermann Hospital. The other guy was taken to the hospital, and his injuries were taken care of. Then the Texas Ranger basically took care of from that point on, took the case. So that's kind of what happened that quick night. When we got to the hospital, they told us that Justin had not made it. And so Amanda and I were able to go down and see Justin. And she stayed for a short time, and I spent some time with Justin. And Pat came down too and spent some time. That was basically it. I asked God, I said, why? Why did you take my son? Because he had so much to offer young kids. And that's what he wanted to do, was work with young kids. And he wasn't going to have that opportunity. So that's basically that part of the story. And
thank you for sharing so much, Mr. Hurst. This is, that's the part. It's tough for every law enforcement to hear, officer, and it should be for the public. somebody making that ultimate sacrifice for them and how it affects the family. Every time I see an officer that goes up on the TV, I think about the family and how it affects them.
Yeah.
And what they're going through, the things you went through, the things my family went through, the things my friends' families have gone through. It tears your heart out every time. And I want people to know that. I want people to know when a law enforcement officer gives his life, it tears out hearts across this nation.
Yeah. They don't understand it. And especially now we've lost so much, I don't want to say respect for law enforcement, but they're going through some extremely tough times. And it's tough in law enforcement right now. I would just, these people need to stop and think, what would we do if we didn't have law enforcement? Mm-hmm. It's just unreal. But,
And your story, your family's story doesn't end there, because we still have the guy that killed Justin who's been arrested. The story continues for you.
Yes, it does. Yeah. Several weeks and everything later on, we had game wardens that were at the house with us 24 hours a day. They never left. Then 3 days later, I think it was, that we ended up having Justin's funeral. And there was approximately 500 law enforcement from all over the state there, and paramedics and fire department and stuff like that. When you live in a small community, mm-hmm. They're all part of first responders, and they're all very, very, very important to the whole community. So, but anyway, we had the funeral, and Justin's body was cremated. They have then been taken out to the bay and thrown into the bay. And some of them we have given to Justin's friends to also take input where locations where Justin would like to be. We took the biologist that had worked with Justin back out to Peach Point. And by the way, now has been changed to Justin Hurst Memorial.
Wow.
Justin Hurst. So we took some of his ashes out there and put them in projects that Justin had created there at the thing. But so that part of it, we went through. The next part then becomes the trial part of it. And we met with the Texas Ranger and the district attorney and everything, and looked at some of the videos that, you know, that they were able to look at and everything that they could see and stuff. So we looked at some of that. And with this was our choice. We wanted to see what happened. We decided, with all the police officers, the different units and everything that were involved, that we would be willing to offer life without parole, and so that the officers wouldn't have to go through all of this trial. Reliving that night again, and it's tough on them. It's tough for them to have to go through something like that and relive it again. Mm-hmm. And we didn't want it. And so we offered the young man life without parole, and he turned it down. Mm. So there was only one direction to go, and that was first degree murder. And execution. That was the plan that our attorneys and the DA and everything, that was what everything was geared up for was now the death penalty. So we went through, later on, we went through 3 weeks of trial. And every day we listened to those same videotapes of the chase that we went through, that entire thing, and all the breakdowns of how many rounds were fired, and the complete, you know, complete thing of what transpired that night. So then it came to the jury, and the jury took 2.5 hours, I think it was, to go ahead and find, you know, him a first degree murder. And then the penalty phase of it, they did the life. I mean, they did the execution. Of course, in that period there, you have numbers of appeals and everything that this young man can get. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so his first appeals came up, and he had 12. He took 12 appeals right off the start. And that's before 9 judges. In all 12 of those appeals, 9 judges voted no on all of those appeals. So then it goes to the next appeal, and then that appeal is over with, and you go through another appeal and another appeal. And finally, we're looking at 10 years down the road. The district attorney called us the 2015 and said, well, he's lost all of his appeals. We now need to sit and talk and decide on his execution because he's lost all of his appeals. So they came over to the house, and a representative from Texas Parks and Wildlife was there, and the district attorney and everything. And they said, well, now it's your turn. And I said, well, what are you talking about? And they said, you get to pick the day that he's to be executed. And that's kind of a tough thing to do. So the holidays were coming and everything. We decided that we would give him his holidays, his Christmas and New Year's and with his family, and let them have as much time with him as they possibly could. The day had been picked, and there was nothing that would interfere with it. And other than if the governor would give him a stay of execution, we had picked the 26th of January. It's always on a Wednesday when the executions are done in Texas. But it wasn't the thing that we just show up and go to the execution. We had to go spend 3 hours of a seminar type thing where everything was explained to us, what was going to happen, the entire procedure of what was going to happen and what we can do and what we can't do that day. So we, and if we were going in to view the execution, then there were certain restrictions that we had to do and couldn't do. And we chose not to go in. We let the law enforcement people that were involved go in and into that part of it. So then it came time for us to go to the facility and everything. And so they put us all in cars and took us to the penitentiary. And of course, you've got your people outside that are against the death penalty and stuff. So we went through that part of it. It was a tremendous education. And you don't think of all these little things when you go through one of these things. The only thing that we could take in to the penitentiary was our driver's license. Mm. Nothing else. I mean, nothing else.
Yes, sir.
We go in, our driver's license had to be turned upside down when we got out of the car so that the news media couldn't read who was going into the execution. Of course, they knew, you know, who we were anyway, but so we got inside, and then our driver's license and everything were checked by one lady, and then another lady had to check them again and make sure that everything was, they were, you know, certified driver's license. Then we went upstairs, went by jail sales and stuff downstairs, and went upstairs, and where we were then searched. One of the guards took a wand and searched us and made sure that we didn't have anything bringing in with us. So we went through that, and then we waited for the
Man in the suits.
Yeah, the warden of the penitentiary to come in and tell us whether or not he had any stays that had come in from the governor or anybody else. And there was no stays. So the execution from that point on was would proceed. So it you know, everything just proceeded. And the group that was going in went to the location, and we stayed upstairs. They went in to observe it. One of the things that was kind of interesting, I was contacted by a police officer out of Houston, and it's a motorcycle group, and it's made up of law enforcement people that ride motorcycles. Mm-hmm. He said, "We just want to know if it will be okay if we come to the execution
outside.
And I said, "I have no problems with it." He said, "Well, let me explain what we do." He said, "We'll be there." And he said, "But when they ask him if he has anything to say, that's when we will rev up our motorcycles outside so that his answer can't be heard." And I mean, we didn't, you know, but when they knew the time there, you could hear them. It's one of these things of law support, and it's just tremendous type of support that you get.
He
decided not to say anything. He never said anything, even during the trial and everything. He never broke a smile or anything. And you know, so we looked at him every day when we were in during the trial. But anyway, so he was executed on that day. We came down and went out, and there was a large group of game wardens and everything that were there with us for support. We've had such tremendous support from Texas Parks and Wildlife and other law enforcement groups. There are several other groups that are tremendous supports. One of them is called COPS, and I don't know if you know anything about COPS.
Yep, I'm from Missouri. COPS, yep, great organization.
Yep. Yeah.
If you want to talk about them, please do.
They are a group that you don't want to be a member of. And when I say that, it's due to the fact that it indicates that you have lost a son or a daughter
or
spouse. Mm-hmm.
Family members.
It's family members is what it is. And that's where the COPS comes in involved. So we became part of that organization. Every year we go up to Arkansas for our parents' retreat. And at the parents' retreat, new members who have lost a son or daughter or relative the previous year will be there. And they go through different meetings and tremendous support. And the big thing about it is that everybody there have been through it. We have lost somebody. So we understand what they're going through. And I think that's the biggest thing that there is that, you know, people say, "Well, yeah, I lost Aunt so-and-so, so-and-so, and I know what you're going through." But it's a different type of hurt and loss that you have. It's amazing how people feel when they get ready to leave, that they feel that they have somebody there to support them and help them. And because we've all been there and we understand what they're going through. So that group is there. The other is the 100 Club. And I don't know if you have that up in you are.
We do.
Pat and I are members of the 100 Club. They had purchased the dash cams and stuff for the two game warden trucks that night that were used. So that's how important what they do is, that they buy the equipment. They had also purchased a vest for Justin, even though it didn't save his life or anything. He at least had a vest. But the 100 Club is a very, very big supporting organization.
Operation B.
I just happen to be the past president of the Wharton 100 Club. So we wanted to get involved in organizations that help and support law enforcement. And so that's what we did. Also, I'm involved in the organization dealing with Texas Parks and Wildlife called Operation Game Thief, which I know you're familiar with. We also, you know, we have now the international organization, which is, I think, doing some great things. But I'm also on the board of directors of Operation Game Thief for Texas Parks and Wildlife. And I did that because I wanted to make sure that our game wardens had the best equipment that they possibly can have. And each year we take and have events. We have sporting clay shoots where we raise money, and we take that money to take and help buy extra equipment that the state won't buy, but we buy special equipment to make the game wardens' job a lot easier and help them in whatever they're doing. So involved in those organizations.
We had the choice when Justin was killed.
Yeah. We had the choice of, you know, when Justin was killed, or what we wanted to do. And Pat and I decided that we wanted to do whatever we could to help other people in law enforcement and support them in whatever way that we possibly can. So that if they do go through what we've been through, hopefully we can make it a little easier for them, like other people have helped us go through what we went through. So that's kind of our story.
I'm going to go back to what Pat said, is trying to make lemonade out of lemons that's just not so sweet. And that's, it sounds like what you're trying to do. You're trying to make it better for everybody in the future. So you can be there, just like, you know, the cops group, that you can be there and support them as much as you've been supported, which is a pretty awesome thing to do for you and your wife. I appreciate it. We met at the International Wildlife Crime Stoppers Conference in Texas. We had some words there.
Yeah.
Certainly, after I started this, I certainly wanted to get back in touch with you so we could tell Justin's story, so you can continue to do what you're doing, Mr. Hurst, and Pat in the background every now and then reminding you.
Hey.
Oh, that's great. Behind every great man is a great woman.
Right. Oh, I like you already.
And I like you too, Pat, I can tell.
There are so many people that after we've been through everything and stuff, and letters and people that made comments about Justin, what type of guy he was, and he was the type of guy that would be honest with you. He had a very soft, low voice. If he was going to check you and stuff, he wasn't going to he was very mild and everything about it, and he would rather educate you and teach you something about if you were doing something wrong. And he was more concerned about that than he was giving you a ticket.
Tell him about walking through the jail.
Oh, yeah. He was walking through the parking lot here in town at the El Campo Police Department. And there's a black gentleman, and he hollered at Justin. Justin waved back to him and asked him how he was doing and everything. And Justin talked to him, you know. And so the other warden said, well, do you know that guy? And he says, yeah, I arrested him 3 nights ago. And he said, and you still have a rapport like that? And he said, yeah. He said, he's a normal person. He said, he understands that he did something wrong. That's the reason he's in here. But we don't hold a grudge against each other. Mm. He has learned that he did something. And that was what I wanted to do, was to teach him that he did something wrong and correct it. So that's the way Justin was. Mm. He'd rather teach you something than penalize you, but he would penalize you.
Nope. That sounds great. It sounds, that's a lot of game wardens are like that. We want to correct the behavior, but we don't hold it against the individual unless they hold it against us. I'm going to throw that in there from my experience.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. You've been there. You understand it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not.
Yes.
Not good.
Well, thank you for all that you guys have done for everybody. Thank you for participating in this memorial podcast. And I'm going to end this. I was doing a lot of research just before we get on and to do this recording, Mr. Hurst. And I found on the Officer Down Memorial page something your wife wrote, which explains a little more about Justin. And yet, when you listen to this podcast, you'll understand her quote a little more. It's from March 16, 2018. It says, it's so hard to believe it was 11 years ago this evening that you were gunned down following a car chase. The years have made each day's passing a little more bearable. However, there is nothing that will change the hole that remains in my heart from your passing. Dearest son, you are missed so much. Help God with all his ducks and geese up in heaven. Pat Hurst, Mom.
She's crying.
Yeah, it's pretty Thank special. You. And I understand the ducks and geese now. That at first I'm glad we had this podcast, because I'm ducks and geese. He must have liked ducks and geese. He loved ducks and geese. So thank you. Thank you guys so much. Thank you, Pat. Appreciate you being the support.
Thanks for what you do.
Yes. Thank you, sir.
Please join me, Game Warden Wayne Saunders, and other game wardens on our adventures protecting wildlife, saving lives, and having fun, all while serving the public and the natural resources of our planet. Listen to the tales and experience of those who work in the outdoors while being entertained with stories about encounters with poachers, wildlife investigation, murder investigation, near-death experiences, search and rescue missions, wildlife interactions from game wardens around the country and around the world. When I retired, I realized I couldn't let go of that legacy, but rather wanted to share the passion, the commitment, and the stories of those men and women that call themselves game wardens. This is Game Warden Wayne Saunders, and this is Warden's Watch.